listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. After more than a decade of peaceful reconstruction, the Central American country of Nicaragua has seen unrest that began developing in earnest in April. Western media is only now beginning to report on it, and its causes are being largely misrepresented, as one might expect. To get the story from someone who's been looking at it up close and living in Nicaragua for a few decades, we spoke with a reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo, from Managua, Nicaragua, via Skype Sunday. So we're going to focus on the area where you live, where you've been living for a long time, and maybe we could start with what's happening there right now in Nicaragua, and then some context of what's happened over the last couple of months.
And if we have time, I'd like also to talk about the way the media is being abused and exploited by the Nicaraguan opposition here.
Absolutely. That's part of the story, for sure.
And the news here is completely distorted, and probably the events that I'm going to describe now will be completely new to people because they're just not getting reported. So on and let's go back on last week, Wednesday, May 30th, it was Mother's Day, and there was a big activity in Managua for peace organized by the government. But on the way down to Managua, a group of people that were going to take part in that peace activity were attacked at a roadblock just south of where I live. One person was killed and 27 were injured by opposition gunmen.
Gunmen?
Oh, yeah.
They got shot.
They were using firearms.
Wow.
A friend of ours who's a police officer was shot in the leg, and they fractured his leg. They broke his leg with the gunshot. So and a very serious incident, but that's just characteristic of everything that's been going on ever since April the 18th. And that simply doesn't get reported in the mainstream corporate media in North America and Western Europe.
Right.
So after that same day, at the peace demonstration, just as it was ending around 4:30, 5 in the afternoon, opposition gunmen also attacked families that were taking part in that demonstration. And I think there were 2 dead, many injured. They, at the third attempt, they burnt down a Sandinista radio station called Radio Nueva Radio Ya, which is a very, very popular radio station, and far from political. It's, most of its output is kind of music and popular entertainment stuff for that people here in Nicaragua really enjoy. But because it's run by the government, the opposition gunmen and paramilitaries attacked it and burnt it down. And in the process, they also wounded 10 police officers and attacked the fire service units that turned up to try and put out the fire. So that was what happened in Managua. Then that same night, the opposition paramilitaries again attacked the municipal office here in Escalí. And in that attack, 2 people were killed, and various people injured. One of the people killed was just a bystander, a guy from out of town who worked in a metal workshop here, just down the road from us. So, and at the same time, the opposition paramilitaries also attacked municipal office in Chinandega. Subsequently, they attacked the municipal office in a town south of Managua called Diriá. They attacked a government complex containing offices of various government ministries in León and burnt down 3 of the modules in that complex. And across the country, of course, they're maintaining their roadblocks, so people can't get around. They can't do the normal things that people do in terms of anything. Economic life, commercial life, sorting out medical care, education stuff, and the whole national life is affected by these roadblocks. The opposition media project as being peaceful, but in fact they're operated by delinquents, many of whom are masked and carrying firearms and other weapons.
I mean, are some of the same tactics that were used, that are used when the unrest is excited in Venezuela, for example.
Well, it's a carbon copy.
Yeah.
Friends from Venezuela write to me when I tell them, they write and ask me, well, what's going on? I write and tell them what's going on. They write back to me and they say, well, this is a carbon copy of what happened in Venezuela all through 2017.
Right.
So, and that's the story. Now, if you say, well, why is this happening? Where did this all start? It goes back to a conversation that we had maybe 2 or 3 conversations ago, when the violence actually started back on April 18th, April 19th. But just as in the Ukraine in 2014 and in Syria and Libya in 2011, the pretext for the violence was completely spurious, because the violence and the protests had next to nothing to do with the claimed pretext, which was a government proposal for social security reform that was made in the days prior to, the weekend prior to Wednesday, April the 18th. And it was subsequently withdrawn on April the 22nd. So the pretext for the protests was completely cut away from underneath the protesters, but they continued their violent protests, and it became very clear that what we're dealing with is regime change.
Right.
This is nothing to do with social security reform.
That social security reform aspect, by the way, it's interesting, the narrative that they're trying to spin, that they're starting to weave in the media here, people that are ostensibly on the left, claim essentially that what happened is that the government, by the way, is not really a leftist government. It's entirely in bed with the IMF and with all of the austerity and all of the things that go with that. And as part and parcel of an austerity package directed at the workers, they wanted to do pension reform, and that has provoked a leftist reaction from the students in defense of workers. That's the way that they're portraying it.
Well, and that's completely ridiculous, because the Social Security reform was actually in a measure that protected workers' rights. And what happened was that after something like 18 months, almost 2 years of negotiations, at a tripartite process involving workers, employers, and the government, the employers withdrew. Why did they withdraw? Because the government proposal affected them more than it affected the workers. And that's the reality, and that's why the private business sector originally supported the protests, but now they're very sorry that they did, because the economy has gone down the toilet.
Yeah.
and they're the ones, the medium to large sized businesses based in Nicaragua, the ones that are most affected. And you can see that in the way that the major, the most wealthy interest, corporate interests in the country, continue to support the protests, because their income doesn't depend on productive activity here in Nicaragua. They've got all their money stashed away in hedge funds and in foreign investments that protect their money.
Right.
They don't depend on the productive economy of Nicaragua.
Right.
And the leftists in North America and Western Europe, when are they going to wake up? This is the same model that we've seen everywhere. I mean, pick a country that's been attacked by the United States. It always starts with a supposed violation of basic civil and political rights. And then it rapidly turns into regime change, an attack on the government. And we've seen it time after time after time, and still the people on the left, who call themselves left, they even call themselves anti-imperialist, they still get it hopelessly wrong. Why do they do that? Well, I don't really know the answer to that, but my guess is, I suspect it's because they're so safely ensconced and comfortably ensconced in the corporate consumer capitalist culture that they claim to criticize, that they're incapable of actually seeing things for what they are.
Mm-hmm.
In places like Nicaragua or Libya or Syria or anywhere else, you know?
And one way of putting that is that they are, trying to parse things on behalf of the working class from a petty bourgeois ivory tower.
Well, yeah, sure. And that's, yeah.
Yep.
And who are they to tell ordinary people in Nicaragua what their reality is?
That's right.
Anyway, and the situation here is that ever since the 18th, on the 18th, those protests were legitimate. In my opinion, they were misguided, but they were peaceful and legitimate. And what happened was that government supporters, young government supporters, clashed with the students protesting against the Social Security reform. And as a result of the public order problems that those clashes provoked, in Managua in particular, the police intervened. And by all accounts, they intervened in a heavy-handed way. But there was no student massacre. That's a lie. One of the big lies about the events of the 18th is that there was a student massacre in which 40 students were killed, which is a downright lie. The first casualties of the violence were a Sandinista police officer, a Sandinista government supporter, and a standby, a supermarket worker who had nothing to do with anything. Mm. And so that was the reality. And then, but the reality quickly changed, because extremist armed groups from the extreme right-wing opposition, groups that are allied with people like Ileana Rose Lehtinen and Marco Rubio in the United States, groups that have actively sought out the support of the anti-Cuban mafia in Florida and the most right-wing elements of the U.S. government. And those elements organized in a very efficient way, a very carefully planned way, the deployment of extremist armed groups that then attacked the police, and then mingling with the students, it was them that provoked the student deaths in a situation in a in circumstances that are completely unclear. I mean, it just happens that we are a friend of the father. We are quite friendly, my partner and I, Louisa, with the father of one of the students that was shot dead in Esteli. Now, he admits that he doesn't know who killed his son, because there's testimony from young people that were involved in the protest that subsequently repented of their participation. It was a hired thugs from El Salvador that killed at least one of those students, and perhaps the second one too. But all that has to be established. And what the government has done is it's played by the book. It's called for dialogue. It suspended the measures that were the pretext for the protests. It asked the Catholic Church to intervene and mediate in a dialogue with the opposition, the very same opposition that was calling for the overthrow of the government and for the government to resign. The government said, all right, well, let's talk. And they asked the right-wing bishops, the ecclesiastical conference here of the Catholic Church, to mediate, so that the opposition had no pretext to say, well, what's the point of the dialogue if there isn't a neutral mediator? And so the dialogue happened. The government invited the Organization of American States to send in a body to investigate the alleged human rights abuses, and that turned up the Commission for the Inter-American Commission for Human Rights sent a delegation that was here for 4 days, did a preliminary investigation, and came to conclusions very similar to the government's own Truth Commission. Both of them are saying, but the Inter-American Commission made its preliminary report about 10 days or so before the government commission made its report. And they said, well, there are 75 dead and around 800 wounded. That's what, 860 or something wounded. And then 10 days later, the government's Truth Commission said, well, what our findings are that there are now 85 dead and just under 1,000 wounded. So what's been happening is that it's the opposition that's been carrying out all the violence. And then they provoke situations in which ordinary Sandinistas and ordinary people that have no political allegiance whatsoever have to defend themselves, but then their media project that as Sandinista paramilitaries attacking the peaceful opposition.
Right.
No, and it's just it's astonishing how the media here, they come here inside Nicaragua, they're completely shameless in the way that they broadcast their lies. And for a long time, I didn't understand why are they telling such downright lies? Who do they expect to believe this? And of course, it's not for domestic consumption.
Right.
It's for foreign consumption.
That's right.
And so
American and European leftists, quote unquote, and anyone else who might try to hamper the United States from, you know, getting directly involved if they decide that's what they have to do.
Yeah, and just look at what's been happening. There have been attacks on municipal offices across the country. What's that got to do with social security reform? What's that got to do with peaceful protests? They burnt down municipal offices.
Well, this is what we were looking at. You mentioned Ukraine, Syria, Libya. I mean, these are the same things that happened. And they even accused in Libya and some Libyan media, but mostly the world media, accused Libya of killing protesters from the air with airplanes, of strafing protesters and such. And even when the Russians said, here's all the aerial photography of that location at that time, there's no airplanes.
Right. And so it might be helpful to look at some of the techniques that the opposition used. For example, they'll say, protesters have been refused medical treatment in the public health system, which is a complete lie.
Mm-hmm.
But why do they say that? They say that because they've already set up their own parallel health system, medical care, for opposition protesters that may get wounded or hurt in the activities.
Mm.
And so their wounds and what happened to them can never be verified.
Right.
So then they'll produce an AK-47 bullet, allegedly, from and of course the order here since at least the weekend of the 21st and the 22nd was for the police not to use firearms, not to fire lethal rounds. And so, that just gives you an idea. So that that's one example. Another example is, for example, the media will say, "Oh, we're being attacked." There's a radio news station called 100% Noticias, which is rabidly anti-government here. And on the night of Wednesday the 30th, they claimed that they were being attacked, when in fact it was them that was encouraging the attack on the Sandinista radio station, Nueva Radio Ya. Yeah. So they claimed that about 7:30, 8 o'clock at night, they were being attacked. And a couple of people, government supporters, went over to take photos of what was happening, and there was nothing happening. There was no attack. It was a complete lie.
Jeez.
And so then other things that happen are that they'll use footage of their opposition paramilitaries attacking somewhere and setting it on fire. And then they'll say, "Look, these are the Sandinista youth. Look at what they're doing, destroying the country."
This is what they did in Caracas when they had the coup in 2002. There were pictures that supposedly showed Sandinista supporters shooting at protesters, except someone came up with a larger contextual picture that included the cropped picture that had been shown,
right.
And it showed, in fact, what was happening was they were being shot by the right wing death squad people.
And it seems very much to be the case that hired killers, either from Nicaragua itself or from Salvador and Honduras, have indeed been killing their own side in order to, because what they need are martyrs.
Right, that's what they did at Maidan as well, right? And in Damascus too, as a matter of fact.
Right. So, and that goes on, and they pull all kinds of tricks to fool people by use of the media. For example, there's an opposition TV channel here called Canal 10. Now, on the issue of the roadblocks, just imagine this, Don. Imagine if around New York, just say at the time of the Occupy Wall Street protests, imagine if the Occupy Wall Street protesters had set up roadblocks around New York so that nobody could get in or out, and they were armed, and they were masked. And what do you think the government response would be? You know, and obviously they'd have called out the National Guard and shot dead the people trying to impose those roadblocks.
Well, all the Black Panthers did was advocate armed self-defense, and we saw what happened to them, and that was 40, 50 years ago.
Right. So, but here what's happened is that because Nicaragua's history is, it's only after over the last 10, 15, 20 years that a process of reconciliation has been able to overcome all the deep-rooted bitterness,
right,
that was left over from the war of the 1980s,
right,
and the insurrection against Somoza of the late 1970s. So the government here, and people generally, are extremely sensitive to any threat of that kind of armed conflict. Anything that smacks of civil war is just abhorred here. Nobody right. wants to go back to that. And that explains why the government is bending over backwards not to send out the police, send out the army, and go in 2 or 3 days they'd clear all the roadblocks. You know, and they could easily put an end to the violence, but all that would happen is that the armed paramilitaries would migrate to an internal urban front, and they'd set up a rural armed front that would just continue to degenerate civil conflict. And that right. is exactly what the government is trying to avoid.
Well, you know, you have this condition of polarity that gets, you know, at both it's a historical legacy, and it's something that gets excited intentionally from Washington, you know, throughout. Just look at the United States even as a model of that now. And so what happens, though, the government in Nicaragua was masterful since Sandinistas won, you know, election after Chamorro, and has done tremendous reconstruction and construction of the economy. Huge benefits to the people there, but they've done it successfully, including engaging the national bourgeoisie, and in the process. And this is something also that gets from so-called leftists in the United States, who could only dream of having that much power to even sit at a table with those people.
Right.
Is a source of deep criticism of class collaboration and betrayal and all of this nonsense, as if they don't know how to spell NEP, for example.
Yeah, no, and it's deep ignorance and deep kind of suburbia is the word, deep arrogance.
Yeah,
because the Nicaragua's economy. And look at the global context in which the Sandinista Front came to power in January 2007.
Right.
What are they going to do? They're going to nationalize everything?
Right.
Give me a break.
Right.
So then what did they do? They set about democratizing the economy, and they've been incredibly successful in that. The associative cooperatives for small family business, micro business, that economy generates 70% of the employment here in Nicaragua. The business sector here in Nicaragua is not the main motor of Nicaragua's GDP.
Right.
The main motor of Nicaragua's GDP is, in order, the popular associative cooperative family-based economy, which contributes over 50% of GDP, around 52-53%.
Mm-hmm.
And then after that, you've got government investment. And then after that, you've got foreign direct investment. Cool. And then well behind that, you've got the contribution of the country's private business sector.
Right.
So it's absolutely stupid and ignorant to say, Danielle is in bed with the local bourgeoisie.
Right.
And it's just so stupid. And in terms of basic social, economic, and cultural rights. And this government has, and over the last 10 years, it's distributed over 100,000 property titles to people across the country. And in Nicaragua, indigenous people have 33, they have property rights to 33% of Nicaragua's national territory.
Wow. Wow.
Right? And remember that Nicaragua is the biggest country in Central America. People often forget that, although it has a small population of only 6.5 million.
Right.
That's because so much of its territory is a virgin forest or land that hasn't been exploited by the corporate capitalist system that dominates countries like El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras. But that's a whole other discussion. And there's the whole environmental discussion, of course. But the nitty-gritty in terms of the economy is that this government has been, certainly in Central American terms, it is the most progressive, socially progressive government in the region.
Right.
Only Venezuela, Bolivia, and Cuba have social indicators for those kinds of things, like participation of ordinary people in the economy, access to basic health and education rights, access to property rights, land reform, all that kind of stuff. All those progressive issues that liberals and progressives and radicals of any stripe in North America and Western Europe should be celebrating, Nicaragua is a regional leader.
And they didn't start from that position. This has been accomplished since 2007.
Absolutely. They were lucky because they had the benefit of the enduring legacy of the revolution of the 1980s.
Right.
But they took office after 17 years of structural adjustment, Washington Consensus, IMF and World Bank imposed policies.
And civil war or whatever, the U.S. war.
Yeah. So then, and as you look at that, and then you try and work out, well, Why does the United States, why do they hate Nicaragua so much? Why do they want regime change in Nicaragua? They want regime change in Nicaragua precisely because Nicaragua represents a mortal threat to the neoliberal corporate capitalist vision of how countries should operate. Nicaragua isn't susceptible to the levels of pillage and looting that you see in countries like Argentina or Peru, for example. And that's why the United States wants regime change in Nicaragua. And there are a whole series of other reasons. I mean, we can talk about the canal and the Interoceanic Canal and stuff like that. But I mean, that is the fundamental reason. And so the socioeconomic model that the Sandinista government under Daniel Ortega has developed over the last 10 years is the reason why the United States wants regime change in Nicaragua. Now, who are their local allies? Who are the allies that these leftists in North America and in Western Europe who criticize the Ortega government and align themselves with the protesters, who are the elements of that opposition to the government here? Well, first you've got Piero Cohen, the wealthiest person in Nicaragua, seventh wealthiest person in all of Central America, according to Forbes magazine. He's promoting the protests. So all those leftists in North America and Western Europe need to ask themselves, do we really want to be an ally of people like Piero Cohen? No, and then you've got Carlos Pellas, who's also an extremely wealthy individual with big sugar interests. I mean, he's kind of essentially held a pistol to the Nicaraguan government's head, because in the previous administration of the neoliberal administration, he extracted a concession, a tax concession, or a tariff concession from the Nicaraguan government administration at the time, enabling his business to sell sugar in Nicaragua at more than the market price. That was one of the reasons why the conflict began in the first place, because there's a tax reform on the table. One of the issues was going to be, well, will Carlos Pellas still get his sugar subsidy? Let those North American liberals and Western European liberals think about that.
That's right.
So then the other thing, there's so many things. I mean, you've got the business sector there.
We have to stop here, and we'll
so much to say.
Yeah, we'll pick it up, and maybe we can go into this again tomorrow or later on in the week, because there is a lot to cover. And Tony, thank you very much. We appreciate your time as always.
Yeah, you're very welcome.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. Italy's recent elections again demonstrate the EU's neoliberal agenda is under continued pressure, even under threat. Where is this grand historic project going? How should we understand the Italian elections, the German elections, and Brexit in totality? Is the current leadership of the EU capable of governing effectively and in line with the wishes of the people it claims to represent? Crosstalking Italy and the EU, I'm joined by my guest, Adriel Cassanta in London. He is a foreign affairs consultant and analyst. Also in London, we have Theophanes Exedaktilos. He's a senior lecturer in European politics at the University of Surrey. And in Milan, we cross to Marco Bassani. He is a professor of political theory at the University of Milan. All right, gentlemen, crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump in anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Theophanes, let me go to you first in London. We have somewhat of a crisis. We'll see where it goes in Italy. We had the majority of Italians going to the polls voting for parties that were against the neoliberal agenda of the status quo. And I would also extend that to the philosophy of the EU. And now we have a non-political technical government. And it looks like it's only a matter of time before there's going to be another election. I mean, where do you see this going? Because on the one hand, you have the elites worried about share values, assets, and that's perfectly understandable. I think that anyone in power would be worried about that. But then you have the democratic process. I mean, how do you balance these two? because this is where it's going to turn into potentially a crisis sometime in the fall. Go ahead, Theophanis in London.
Yeah. Well, we're still riding the wave of populism across Europe. The populist parties are gaining momentum still. It was thought that it had stopped a little bit or retrenched maybe with the French election, which you didn't mention. But we see again in Italy now is one of the worst affected countries in terms of the economic strains. It was the next one to go. We were expecting it in terms of the financial capabilities of the country. The turmoil has been going on for the last 80 days or so. The non-appointment of the new government is the kind of the last element to this saga. But we do expect it to be resolved somehow. It's fine for democracy. Democracy doesn't have dead ends. It only has solutions. So I'm pretty sure the solution will be found in Italy. Now, on the European side, that's a whole different story because it is a mixture of technocrats and elected representatives and what we call Eurocrats at the same time. So I think that there needs to be a wider European discussion about the values of European integration, about the prospects of European integration, and about a roadmap of how to go about it and taking into account some of the issues that have been highlighted by the electorates.
You bring up a very good point there. Let me go to Marco in Milan. But, you know, my sense is Brussels doesn't really care about what the people of the EU think about the strategy ahead because they don't have a European Union-wide election on should we continue integration? Should we vote on a constitution? It's not done that way. And I think that's part of the alienation of a lot of the publics in the European Union. Theophanis brought up something that I think is interesting. Is this a one-off Italy in a certain moment in political and economic and social history? Or is it really part of this wave that Theophanis mentioned in London? Go ahead, Marco in Milan.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if it's the European Union is really a Cold War tool. It's nothing else. You know, the United States wanted one voice, one single voice in Europe. It never worked. And then right now it's a recipe for economic stagnation, especially in Italy. And it's felt like that. The whole point of the European Union was just to sort of hide what was the French weakness and to hide the German strength. But there are certain things, you know, that you cannot hide anymore. So I guess it was the elite. The elite wanted this Europe very much, but there's no European vision anymore. There is nothing like the real problems that are there, economic stagnation. Italy has been in like no growth for 20 years. Germany's been growing at a rate which is 0.6, 0.7 after unification, which is certainly not enough. There is nothing like a robust economic growth, and there is a lot of immigration. People are worried that their societies are changing very rapidly,
yeah.
And there's no common European vision on that.
Okay.
Right.
Let me go to Adriel in London. Right now, I mean, and I look at the election, the Italian election. I mean, and you, I may be wrong. My impression was is that we had these populist parties on the left and the right questioning the policies of the status quo in Italy and the European project in general. But they're not saying to get out of the European Union, but not yet. Now, between now and the next election, if there is no progress made, and we could see the left and the right work together much more closely in the next election, and if they do get way more than the majority, then you may have membership in the EU on the table. And it's moving in that direction because, you know, the economic crisis there, ever since the financial crisis of 2008, I mean, the perception is the banks were protected and nobody else. And it was all at the direction of Brussels and Berlin. Go ahead, in London.
I think that people are generally thinking the idea of European Union as a utopia. And once many political analysts are seeing resemblance between the Austro-Hungarian Empire and the EU, I would say that there's a more resemblance between the collapse of the Soviet Union and breakup of the EU. I think that the EU and the Soviet Union were both or are both ingrained in the utopian idea. European Union as a customs union, yes. All Europeans and all the people around the world are eager to do business. But a part of that, we can see a huge disparity between the general populace, labor, general workers, and the elites, business elites. And this is going breaking down to and resonates with the populistic parties, because we can see that some people in our society, the majority, the real majority, is left behind. This is the main problem is that the political elites around the European Union are living in a utopia, and they are out of touch with the realities of the common people. So they are representing the big businesses, the markets, investors, so on and so forth, which are crucial to well-being of the nation state. But at the same time, those very corporate entities, what is their value without the common man?
Okay.
So this philosophy doesn't hold the water, and I think that this is the main problem. That
okay.
If the political elites around the Europe will not grasp the reality, they will find themselves in a very nasty situation, and pushing us to do slightly drastic things.
I very well said, except for one word you didn't use. You didn't use democracy in all of that, and I think that's the problem here. They have found this here. I mean, you know, people talk. I'll get back to you. Theophanes, let me go to you in London. There's a lot of talked about this populist movement and the rise of the right. But it's not the rise of the right. It's the failure of the status quo. And I think, you know, the elites and the media can't, you know, you can't trust these people to rule. Well, then you can't trust democracy. You can't have it both ways. Go ahead, Theophanes in London.
This is probably one of the few times I'll agree with you, Peter. There,
okay.
That it is the failure. It is the failure of the mainstream parties to capitalize on the demands of the people. However, I would disagree with the fact that elites are completely disjointed or in no connection with the common people. I don't really like the expression common people, and I don't like the expression of the left behind. And I can tell you why. Because it is really easy to fall into the trap of emotional language that populist parties are using.
Good point.
I don't see populist parties doing anything different at
Good
this
point.
Stage than what they have promised to that common people that they claim to represent. So in fact, in this case, I think it is a political agenda with high political stakes. They want to go into power for their own purposes. And I think that a lot of the people that they claim to represent are falling into the trap of becoming victims of this emotional language.
Mm.
I think we need to sit down and rationally think about what the problems with the European integration program are, what the actual needs of the people are, both in economic and in social terms, and see and find ways of being at least progressive in our ideas and pragmatic in the way that we handle things on the ground.
Okay, Theophanes, let me go to Marco and Milano before we go to the break here. I mean, when you look at the two leading parties in the last election in Italy, do you think that they are capable of ruling, even though they've been pushed aside for the time being? Do you think they have the wisdom to be able to move forward and to capitalize on their victory? Go ahead, in Milan.
Yes, yeah. I don't know if they do. Actually, what I'm seeing is the political class that they have produced, both of them, is really like the lowest kind of human beings I've seen rule in a country in my whole life. Most of them can hardly speak Italian in a correct way. So it's It's really something pretty bizarre. You know, these people are not exactly very cultivated, but that's the story. These are populists, as you call them. Now, who are populism? Who are the populist groups? What do they do? Usually, you know, one definition in political science is the people or the parties, the movements that try to exploit the fears of the people.
Marco, I got to jump in here, gentlemen. I have to go to a hard break. And after that hard break, we'll continue our discussion on Italy and the EU. Stay with RT.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Okay, let me go back to Marco in Milan. Before we went to the break, you were talking about the nature of populists and populist movements right now. Go ahead.
Yeah, there are certain fears that the people have. You know, they feel they're left behind. Yes, they are left behind. And they do know that you called it neoliberalism. It makes me laugh. You know, Europe is like public expenditure in France. In France and in Italy is about 57% of GDP. I really wonder what kind. It's a welfareist utopia. It's nothing else but a neo-socialist agenda. There is no doubt about that. But of course, it's a neo-socialist agenda in which big business can thrive, as it did. You know, it's a collusion between big business and big government, but clearly there is a lot of big government in that. Now, first, you were before. Our guest was comparing it to the USSR, and I would compare the European Union to the Holy Roman Empire. And so in the 1700s, that had no effect whatsoever in European politics. And as Voltaire used to say, it's neither holy nor Roman, nor it's not even an empire. And so it's clearly, it's not European, it's not a union. Well, it's a European idea. It's a utopia, but most people in Europe just believe that it is certainly not effective in their lives.
Well,
you see,
I mean,
what was
hang on here. You know, to be fair here, there are a number of cases where the European Union is genuinely popular in the European Union. This is part of the divide among member states here. Let me go back to Adriel in London here. Again, if we use the Italian election as a microcosm, I mean, the issues that were on the table: immigration, lack of growth, youth unemployment. Do they have the tools? Because the populist parties will say that their hands are tied because it's Brussels and Berlin pushing austerity. Is that just passing the buck? Because these are real issues with real voters, and it seems to be all across the European Union. And I'd like to talk, gentlemen, a little bit about Brexit before we finish up here. Go ahead, Adriel, in London.
I think that we are missing the point that what was held in 2014 by the Harper's magazine was the panel debate where one of the professors from London School of Economics, Professor John N. Gray, was taking part in this debate, and it was titled How Germany Reconquered Europe. I agree with that statement, obviously, but when it comes to immigration deficit in the countries, so on and so forth. First of all, we know that this is a problem. Immigration is a huge problem, but this is not the problem European Union or European states in the first place. This is a problem which was caused by the administration of Mr. Bush when he started his war on terror in 2002. The people who are to be blamed for the immigration, mass immigration from the Middle East, are Americans. Not Americans per se, but the government and
foreign
policy. But
you have to be fair. Hang on. We got to be fair here. I mean, Angela Merkel said, open the doors, let a million people in. It wasn't the U.S. president that said that, okay? I mean, I get the gist of your point, okay? If you bomb people, they tend to leave, okay? Yeah. And they want to go to a richer place. Ergo, don't bomb them and maybe invest in their countries so they don't want to leave, okay? So, I mean, let's keep it balanced there. Theophanes, let me go to you, because you know, dealing with these issues, dealing like immigration, you know, let's just focus on that one. I mean, this issue's been around for a while. It's getting more intensified, but it's been there. And, you know, I my knowledge of Italy and that in the issue of immigration, I mean, for some communities, it's dire. It's dire. People just walking off the beach. I mean, when you and all of us on this program, when we go to a foreign country, we get on an airplane, we go through lie detectors, we go through metal detectors, we have our passports checked, we're checked. And now you have people just coming onto the beach and walking in. I mean, that is something that if I lived in an Italian community, I would be furious about. I mean, at least of all the security issue. Go ahead, Theophanis in London.
Yeah, I mean, this has been accentuated by the refugee crisis. So we need to be a little bit careful about the immigration side and the refugee side. The same happens in Greece. But let me tell you something, Peter. The majority of the people who voted for the populist parties have not even come across a single immigrant in their communities. So, I mean, sometimes it's like Brexit. The areas that voted Brexit in the UK have the least problem of immigration. They're largely white British areas. So the Lega narrative there is very interesting. It's trying to break through some of those regional issues into more national debates. And I think here we are in the same situation as we were in Greece a couple of years ago, and we had the same discussion at that particular moment. Actually, all those populist parties, they talk about immigration, but from being responsive to people's desires to being responsible in how they handle immigration, that's a whole huge divide. And they rely on Europe to actually provide that common framework, to provide the resources. And they rely on other richer countries to take on the bulk of the immigrants, because that's how they will, they think they will get rid of the problem. So it's a matter of blame shifting. They shift the blame around. They pass the baton. They throw the ball in other countries' courts. So that's why I insist on the fact that there's need to be some sort of central agreement that respects the kind of intricacies that each of those countries has, and respects the kind of problems that are there.
Yeah, but okay, Marco, let me go to Marco. I want to stay with the issue of immigration here. I mean, if you look at what Donald Rumsfeld called New Europe and Old Europe, okay? I mean, I lived in Poland for 10 years, okay? The Poles, the Czechs, the Slovaks, the Hungarians, they don't want these people. They say, we didn't create this problem. Why should they come here? I mean, there's no unity within the European Union itself. Theophanis, you said that you want to have a discussion about it. Well, I mean, a considerable number of countries within the European Union already think that discussion's over. The answer is no. Okay?
And so, have a discussion, Peter. We don't have a discussion, even in Poland. We don't have discussion. It's only scaremongering, resonating with the people who, as my previous colleague said rightly, never seen in their life, even in Poland, never seen in their life, and are a person.
But at the same time, to all of you, then I'll go to Marco. Irrespective if you've seen one or not, you've seen the effects that it had on other countries. And I think that's the demonstration effect that people are absorbing. And I think that's kind of a middle ground there. Okay, Marco in Milan, go ahead, jump in.
No, I jump in on immigration. You know, there are certain things that clearly intellectuals should not even say, but I don't see anything wrong in the desire of the common people to die in a society that is pretty much the one in which he was born. And the same in California, in Florida, in New York, in Milan, in Lombardy, or anywhere else. You know, there is this desire of the common people not to change too much. I mean, if you close a society is going to die. If you open the borders too much, same thing will happen. You know, I see it in Milan a lot. And clearly, the Eastern Front, you know, from the Czechs, the Polish, and so on, they don't want to open their society so much. And European elite, so they decided something else. Actually, they let Italy go on with their immense national debt if they agreed that in the past 5 years they would let anyone in. And in fact, more than 600,000 people got in this country in 5 or 6 years, so in less than that. So it's really a big problem. And it's also there are people that are learning certain things, that it's not so difficult to integrate Christians, but it may be a little bit more difficult, this integration of Muslims. I mean, it's a very normal thing, but nobody in Europe. There are certain things, of course, you cannot say because we have freedom of religion, and but it could be a little bit more difficult to integrate Muslims.
Okay, well, absolutely. Every society is interested in making sure that they have cultural references that they can keep. I mean, it's their culture, their society, and rapid change can be very upsetting to people. I think there's historically we've seen that here. Theophanes, let me go back to London. Hang on. Let me go to Theophanes. Sorry. In London. Another issue, going back to the Italian elections here, is the euro. I mean, what is there's the pressure on leaving the euro. I mean, we already saw it with Greece. I mean, Greece was not allowed to. The amazing pain that's going happening to Greece and will continue for probably a very long time. What is the message now in dealing with the euro when we keep Greece in our mind when it comes to Italy? Go ahead, Theophanes in London. Yeah.
We now have the similar situation as to Greece a couple of years ago with the referendum. Recent polls do demonstrate that Italians want to be inside the Eurozone and use the euro, which is very interesting because it contradicts directly the kind of message that the Five Star Movement and Lega are putting forward. So there is this kind of interesting dynamic of we want the whole cake.
And eat it too.
And eat it. So it doesn't work that way for political parties. They need to find a compromising solution. And the problem is definitely neoliberalism and is definitely capitalism. So perhaps the answer is not to destroy everything that we've built so far, but try to create a new paradigm that really tries to combine elements of capitalism.
Okay.
Let me jump in here.
We're rapidly running out of time. Adriel in London, when is Brexit going to happen? I got 30 seconds. Tell me. I'm waiting.
Well, Brexit will never happen, Peter. We know that Brexit will never happen, and I would call this a Humpty Dumpty politics, because Mrs. May is sitting on the wall, and once the March next year will come, she will fall. So we will have Remexit. So something in between remaining and going away. But Brexit will never happen.
All right, we've run out of time here.
Everything to the
wall that Theresa May is sitting on. I wish they would move to the Mexican border. That's all the time we have, gentlemen. Many thanks to my guests in London and Milan, and thanks to our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time, and remember, Crosstalk rules.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.